Are high interest rates killing your investment deals? Well, you might just be in the wrong niche. And that is why we're talking to Beth Underhill on today's episode. Beth is a real estate investor whose company owns close to 500 beds in student housing. We dissect this niche of student housing from A to Z on today's episode. We talk about how to find the right market, how to find the right deal, and how to set yourself up for success when it comes to managing these properties. You cannot miss today's episode. Welcome to the Invest Her podcast. I'm Liz Faircloth.
And I am your co-host, Andressa Gadelli.
I'm running solo today, so I'm going to just jump in here with our guest, Beth. So excited that you're here. And we are going to talk all things student housing. So for so many investors, they are challenged with deals not penciling out. The deals are just not making sense financially. So my question to you, with the amount of experience you have in student housing, why is it such a compelling niche right now for investors?
Great question. And for us, and when I say us, I obviously partner with a couple of different entities or groups, I should say, to purchase these student housing properties. So it's not all me. But really, I would say the reason why is that student housing's always been actually a good asset class. I think most people just don't know about it. Most people, when they envision student housing, their very first thought is they think of John Belushi and Animal House. And they're in their mind, they are envisioning this old house that, you know, is filled with a bunch of college students. There's kegs everywhere, beer cans in the front yard, trash and so forth, parties all the time. And they're thinking to themselves, why would I ever want to put myself through that in terms of being a landlord and having to deal with tenants such as that? What we are actually purchasing are purpose-built student housing properties. So these are designated student housing properties close to campus. They are not run by the universities. They're obviously run by, managed by people like ourselves, operators. And these properties essentially are thriving right now because really with a lot of your universities, we're seeing enrollment grow. And I know there's kind of this misconception out there that, oh, nobody's going to college anymore, but that's really not true. You know, colleges, universities, they've experienced so much post-COVID. I know for instance, my daughter, she goes to the University of Kentucky. She's entering her junior year. Her freshman year, they did not have enough on-campus housing for all of the incoming freshmen. So guess who was the beneficiary of that? It was anybody who owned off-campus student housing properties. So we're just seeing this uptick in student housing properties. You know, where we like to focus, we like the SEC market. And the SEC market, of course, is related to athletic programs. And the SEC schools always have strong athletic programs. And as a result, you're just going to see these students flock to those programs. And sometimes they're flocking to the programs simply because they want to be a wildcat or they want to be a gator. They want to be a bulldog. You know, they're going where all of the excitement is.
I love it. There's so many questions just to pull from that answer
sure.
that you
yeah.
just said. So I love it. So in a lot of ways, I think you said something really important that so many people, their deals are not penciling out. Part of the reason their deals may not be penciling out is not just because of interest rates. It also can be that your customer, right? They don't, for what you need to rent it for, there's no customers to yield that, meaning it's not the right asset to buy or it's not the right market. So many people are just like, oh, the interest rates are high and that's why it doesn't make sense. Well, yes and no, it really depends. And what you're saying, and you're really zoning in on it very, very, very powerfully, is that it is about the market and the housing shortage, right? And solving a problem from like more of like a macro perspective versus it just like, you know, my deal's not penciling out. And so I just love that because I really want to dissect student housing. I'm personally and selfishly incredibly curious about this niche. So all my questions are just selfish for me and hopefully some people will listen. But so let's dive in a little bit about, because you said a few really important things. Let's talk about the market.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, I would have gleaned that that the market are where universities are. But I also think strategically, knowing what I know about real estate, not all university towns are created equal. So to your point that you just said, you said SEC.
Mm-hmm.
It is SEC, the SEC.
Right.
And what does that stand for?
Southeastern Conference.
Okay. And now what does that mean though? Again, that just speaks to an athletic.
So athletic programs are grouped as like Big Ten Conference, the Pac-12, the SEC. So the Southeastern Conference, think as far south as the University of Florida or the University of Alabama, and then as far north as the University of Kentucky. Actually, the University of Kentucky is the northernmost SEC school, and I don't even consider Kentucky really south, so to speak, probably because it's so close to where I live, which is Ohio.
Now, is that a line? Because I'm always coming at it from a multifamily perspective. So, you know, you in so many ways, you know, the Southeast has been where we focus. So we have multifamily in Kentucky and North Carolina. We're very interested in those markets and have grown our portfolio there. Is there a similar path of saying, okay, we focus on college towns in really the Southeast, similar to what you're saying, for similar reasons, different reasons, or they just seem to, it's just ironic that I'm curious to get your insight, because I know you also invest in multifamily.
One of the reasons that's a driving force to where we actually will focus has a lot to do with scholarship programs by states. So for instance, Georgia, where we have several assets, they have an in-state program. It's called the Hope Scholarship. And we are seeing that some of the colleges and universities, incoming freshmen, as many as 98% of these incoming freshmen are receiving these Hope Scholarships. Essentially, they're being paid to go to school. So as a result, you know, hypothetically, let's say mom and dad have earmarked, you know, X number of dollars for college tuition. All of a sudden, that number has changed because Susie received a scholarship to go to the University of Georgia. Well, now mom and dad are like, oh, bonus, right? We have all of these extra funds. And as a result, they are going to ensure that Susie now is put up, you know, if she needs to live off campus, either first year, second year, however that works out, you know, she's going to live in a pretty decent place. And so they're going to spend that extra money on a lot of these purpose-built student housing properties. Now, some of these purpose-built student housing properties, I mean, they are, it's a wide array in terms of amenities that they offer. Many of ours do not have amenities, and actually we go after ones that aren't highly amenitized so that it keeps the cost down. But nonetheless, they're all Class A, purpose-built student housing properties. And so those Class A properties, these kids are more inclined to take care of these properties as a result of them being just so nice, so luxurious. And then, of course, the fact that mom and dad are signing on the leases, you know, something happens, who's going to be paying for it? Mom and dad will be, but who's going to be hearing about it? Mom and dad are going to be yelling at Susie or Joe or whomever, you know, if they've damaged property and whatnot. So it's a very interesting, you know, scenario, but yes, we are going after properties that really are in markets in which some of these students are, you know, through scholarship programs are able to spend those dollars that they would have spent on tuition can spend it in other places.
That's I've never heard that before, to be honest. And I think that's a very strategic, very smart, very strategic. So my next thought goes, though, so if these are Class A buildings, amenities, more luxurious, you know, the nicer a property, arguably the person's going to keep it, you know, better than, you know, the frat house, if you will, just to use that as an analogy, because that's what just pops in my head in horrible places that I used to see when I was in college. But my question is, does it then delineate to the town? Meaning, you know, is the area also have to be Class A? And you know, a lot of these college towns, the college is the main attraction. It's not like some others have this more downtown area. Like I just went to Charleston. Charleston, you would argue, is a Class A neighborhood, right?
Sure. Right.
People are coming with discretionary income. They're going to the beach. I mean, every shop after every shop had very, very, you know, luxury items in those stores, right?
Mm-hmm.
Certain
sure.
type of person that's going to Charleston. And there's a ton of kids, not kids. Well, they're kids to me now, but I'm looking around because we had a meeting there last week and there was tons of college kids walking around and I'm like, they're going to the same restaurants. It's just so interesting. So is that also my question is that the actual markets, do they vary in terms of like class A environment, or does it not need to be a class A environment for these properties to be class A? And that also works depending on the market. I'm curious.
I think that's a really strong question. But I think over time, some of these markets, as a result of the university, have actually gone from maybe being maybe a class B, you know, area, and have turned themselves into more of a class A market neighborhood simply as a result of the university itself and all of the dollars that come into it. I know for us in the markets that we have chosen, I would definitely say that they are more class A markets. Now, I will say this. We do have one property that is in Tennessee. It is just outside of Nashville. Murfreesboro, it's called. It's about 20 minutes outside of Nashville. I'd probably give that maybe more of a B plus type area, B plus market, you know, comparative to Nashville, for instance. So, but we have a property, 252 beds, that's thriving. It's literally 0.3 miles away from campus. So it's right on the outskirts of campus, 100% pre-leased for this academic school year. So, I think, you know, it's really enrollment definitely is driving, you know, the success of so many of our properties.
Yeah. And I love that you're saying from a market perspective that they have this discretionary income that they wouldn't have had if they hadn't gotten the scholarship. So looking at colleges that are, you know, really heavy on that side of scholarship, especially from an athletic perspective, is such a phenomenal tip, you know, that you shared. I'm curious though, let's go to type of properties. Cause in my mind, you have people listening right now, like, yeah, I even have some properties in college town that I may want to convert to student housing. So if you got people listening there and or looking at markets, maybe that they can take down themselves, right? They may not be doing a 250, purpose-built property, as you're referring to it. It totally makes sense. More new construction, higher end, you know, makes sense. Could they still participate? Is there a place for them in these markets? It meaning maybe less than 10 units, close to campus, and it's student housing.
Oh, absolutely. And honestly, my daughter, who is, as I mentioned earlier, entering into her junior year, she's actually living in a house that is three blocks away from her campus. And it is a house that has five beds. And this is student housing. The entire street, as a matter of fact, is student housing, but it's just their houses. And so, you know, people are turning four bedroom, five bedroom, six bedroom homes into student housing, which is a very popular trend right now outside of student housing, essentially pad split co-living. So it's kind of interesting to see this trend that's happening that's already been happening for a long time.
Right. It's not like a new trend. Yeah.
Right. It's not a new trend at all.
Yeah. But the reason that people are, we had a woman on a few episodes ago, I'll put it in the show notes about co-living and how she's, you know, how she's managing it and how she's doing it. And, cause the immediate thought is it's a management nightmare, right? Cause then you're renting by the room. And also I'm curious about from a lending perspective, cause I was actually talking to a lender the other day and they said, you have to be really careful cause that's now more of a, you know, concern for some lenders. They don't want to rent by the room cause that just sounds like a whole other nightmare for the lender. So, but I'm curious though, from the perspective of, you know, the beds and stuff. So say someone wants to look, they live outside of, you know, they live in, you know, in this Southeast area where they don't live and they're considering an area. They see this upswing in the colleges and it kind of meets the criteria that we've talked about so far. How do they go about ensuring that the property can be converted to there's some cities that, you know, can only have two rooms on that could be done in that house. Meanwhile, there's five bedrooms and you're like, okay, that doesn't make any sense for that area. So how do you assess the area to ensure student housing is, there's regulations or not regulations? Is it similar to like short-term rentals where if there's no regulations, that's a problem because there's no one doing it. Or that there's regulations that are fit friendly to people wanting to do that strategy. So how would someone who's new to this niche assess if they can do it or not, and how can they?
Sure. First thing first is do some research, see if there are ordinances, regulations within the area that you're looking at. I am not aware of any that necessarily stop individuals from doing this sort of thing. And I think especially if you're near a college town, you're probably not going to see a lot of restrictions surrounding something like that. So I would do some research, number one. I would talk to people, talk to neighbors, talk to, people in and around the area. Find out if there's anyone else, if you've seen a couple of different properties, talk to realtors, actually. Realtors might even have a good pulse on something like this as to areas that might work well. Obviously you want to find things that are close in proximity to campus. The closer you are, the better your chances are going to be that you'll be able to rent, this house to students and so forth. The further students are away, we generally see that they're not as inclined to engage on campus, drive to campus and so forth. It makes it more challenging. So, you do want to be as close to campus as possible. But I think of my daughter right now. She's living in a house, 5 beds, paying $600 per room. Or per bed, per room, however you want to look at it. There's 5 bedrooms. The landlord, she's had this house now probably for, I think I looked it up online, 20 years. So more than paid off. And it's a legacy house. So, and really, if you can actually find a property and make it a legacy house. And a legacy house is essentially, my daughter's part of a sorority. So what that means is in 2 years, so she signed a 2-year lease for her junior and senior year. After her senior year, there's going to be girls who are living in the house right now, sorority house right now, that want to move off campus. And they're just going to keep kind of cycling through everyone from that same sorority, through this house. So essentially, this property is going to continue to generate income for as long as this particular owner is going to hang on to it. And she will always have a pool of girls, of college students to pick and choose from.
Let's talk about, I found this property, it's a single family, has 5 bedrooms. It's not set up by rent by the room yet, which, consists of making sure there's locks on the doors and different kind of pieces of that puzzle. How would somebody walk a property and say, this is great for student housing, besides it being close? And let's, before I ask this question, close to proximity, I want to be really clear. We're talking what mileage, half a mile, quarter of a mile? What are we talking?
I would say within a mile from campus.
Within a mile. Okay. Good rule of thumb. So, all right. This property is within a mile of campus, and I'm assessing, how do I insure and how do I underwrite and ensure that this is going to make sense? Is vacancy different, right? Because it's not what are the first steps in kind of underwriting and ensuring the deal makes sense when you're new to this niche?
Sure. So that's a great question. Now, I will preface this by saying all of the properties I've ever underwritten have been ones that
like 100 plus, something
right,
a little larger.
Right. Yeah. So doing something smaller, and certainly run the numbers on what a mortgage is going to cost on this particular property. And that's really going to, your mortgage, taxes, insurance, run all those numbers. Obviously, utilities are going to be paid by the tenant. So you don't need to factor that in. Obviously factor in any maintenance that may need to be done on a monthly basis as well, snow shoveling, garbage, and things along those lines. So sum up all those numbers, and then, figure out per bed just exactly how much you would be able to get. And that's going to come through research, talking to other people. It's so funny because once I started telling people that I was involved in student housing, I had more people tell me, oh yeah, I used to own some student housing near X, Y, and Z university and so forth. So talk to other people because you easily can find out what the going rate is. And let's say you do have 5 rooms, for instance, multiply whatever that going rate is by 5, do the math, subtract, and you'll be able to see, oh, okay, great. We can get, and I think what's interesting is that like when you think about renting a room to five people, for instance, if we have a five-bedroom house versus renting it to one family, you ultimately are going to get more from five people than you will from one family. And that's just based off of rates. It's definitely a viable option. But yeah, run the numbers and just make sure that you've factored in everything. I mean, everything that you would need to factor in for just
any type of deal. Yeah.
Any type of deal, any house, really, if you're buying a house, what's this going to cost me every month?
But the, you know, the income shifts because it is by person, not complicated, but you want to almost look at, you know, for what you're offering, just like anything, right? What product you're offering, what is the average, what's high, what's low, and what, you know, how close is the property? All the things we would kind of consider. Because rent shifts, you know, rent changes, especially if I would imagine there's always a play, just like in anything. If you have these purpose-built properties and maybe they're going for $1,000 for that single room, there's a place for the smaller properties, less rent, of course, because you can't demand the same rent as something that you're probably building. But you're solving a problem too because of X, Y, and Z and people's budgets and things of that sort for arguably a good property. So you want to look at supply and demand always. And you know, and people forget that. It seems like such common sense in our business, but it isn't for a lot of investors, especially. So what's happening, you know, and if there is a, you know, if there's high demand and low supply, that's, you know, that's thumbs up, right? Because you're going to be part of the solution to everything you just said, Beth. I'm curious though, management. How much of a line item do you put in management? I'm assuming at the size properties you're dealing with, do you guys have your own management company? Do you outsource that? Like, how do you set it up?
Several of our properties, we actually have a property management company that is handling. And these are student housing specific property management companies. So that's all they deal with. There two of our smaller properties, we actually self-manage. So in other words, we have somebody that's on site and then we work with her directly to manage the properties. Now, this particular person, she's been managing this, like one of the properties for a while. Now she's taking on a second property. So it works. Now, if you're thinking about, you know, a five-bedroom house, managing that, you know, I mean, really, it's quite simple, right? I mean, once you actually get your tenants and they sign that lease, you know, one thing about student housing that most people don't realize is that you sign a 12-month lease. So it's not just the academic year. So if you are pulling in these students, they're signing from August until all the way through the following July. And so you don't have to worry about, you know, whether or not they decide to stay in the property or in the house for those 3 months that they might not be in school, you're still receiving that rent. And what I would also recommend too is that if you do decide to go this route and you buy, you know, you buy a house and it's got five rooms, however many rooms and so forth, make sure that you get the parents to actually guarantee the leases. What's interesting about my daughters is that the landlord never had any of us parents guarantee the lease. So it's all on our children, our girls. So I found that to be very interesting, especially coming from the space in which we are actually getting guarantees from parents or a guarantor of some sort for these purpose-built student housing properties, but she did not get one. But I would highly recommend that if you want to go into student housing, get those parental guarantees.
So are there people who are actually putting together student housing? They have a property. They want that to be the niche that they focus on. Are there people who are not getting any sort of parental guarantee? Like, who would do that? Like, in my mind, I'm like, why would that makes no sense to me. But is there people who would just rent to the students as is, if you will, and not have that? Oh, wow. Okay.
Her argument, when I asked her about it, she said, you know what? They're 20 years old. And so they're old enough to be. Yeah. And I said, okay, you know, fair enough. But here I was trying to help her and protect her.
Yeah.
Like, don't you want my guarantee? And she didn't want it. I now, thought, okay.
Would you do that through grad school? You could argue that grad students are there to study. They're a little more, you know, serious. Or is it just the rule of thumb, would you say, from, you know, more of that, you know, 4-year college?
No. As a matter of fact, grad students, we welcome grad students. In fact, one of our properties probably caters more to grad students.
Mm-hmm. Which is a whole other kind of niche within a niche, right?
Right.
Which is interesting. So rookie mistakes, you know, I'm listening to this and I'm like, I need to buy property and focus on student housing. I'm intrigued. All right. I'm letting go of Animal House. All right. And I'm really intrigued. How do I set myself up for success from a management perspective in the sense of they're renting by the room, but they're still sharing common space, right? Whether that's the kitchen, the, you know, there's a maintenance piece there, there's a management piece that's still there. Now, the on-site property, the on-site manager that you have, I'm curious to understand that. How many units is that for? Rooms. I'm out of the vernacular. How many rooms is that for?
That is actually 126 beds.
Okay. Beds. Gotcha. I know, I'm like a door. I'm like the multifamily person. I'm like, what do you call it? Okay. So 106 beds. You have an on-site.
126.
So folks listening may not be starting with that type of property, right?
Probably not.
Where does it make sense? Like if you had a 5-bed property, if you will, you're looking to take, you know, to buy that, to manage it. What do they want to do from a management perspective so they set themselves up for success?
First things first, come up with a legal agreement that you feel most comfortable having that protects you, that really protects you and that protects you and the students. I think that's going to be the most important thing. Come up with what your guidelines are going to look like. Rules, if there's going to be any sort of rules for the house, you know, who's responsible for what, you know, what the tenants are going to take care of, what you're going to take care of. You know, that's the interesting thing. So the lease agreement that my daughter signed, there weren't a whole lot of, you know, things spelled out, like just simple things such as who's cutting the grass, right? So we had to go back and ask that question, like, are you responsible for the grass? Are we responsible? So simple things like that. I would just make sure that you have clearly, you know, looked at this as a whole and delineated who is doing what. You know, focus on your lease agreement and then really start marketing. Start marketing to, and you want to start marketing, you know, ideally the best time is to start marketing as soon as school year begins. You want to market for the following year because we have students already signing lease agreements, you know, right now for next year.
Are there specific places that, you know, if I have that 5-unit, are there specific sites that are gearing towards just student housing or students looking for housing? Or no, is it more just like, you know, they can find it anywhere, Zillow, et cetera?
You know what? That is a really good question. And there very well might be for like within each of the universities and colleges, there might be something where there you can post and so forth. And one of the things to do too is I would go let sororities and fraternities know, like, hey, I've got this property that's going to be available next year. Because you could turn it into that legacy property where you continuously have, you know, year after year, either gals from a sorority or guys from a fraternity always renting that particular house.
That's a phenomenal tip. That was like, you know, everyone, hopefully you heard that tip. And you can go to like a sorority, a fraternity. I'm also thinking of there's what is it called? Not educational fraternities, but service fraternities. There's so many, think about like the epitome of community. That's where it all begins in college, right? People are kind of finding their people. And there's so many of those groups that you can, beyond the sororities and fraternities, which makes complete sense because those folks tend to live together. But I would imagine there's other groups on campus that are also continually graduating people and bringing people in. And it's like this really close-knit kind of group that stays in touch with each other. And there's like this, you know, kind of community feel in a sense. And they're looking for that beyond the, because some universities might have, you know, cracked down on certain sororities, fraternities, but there are different groups of people who are coming together in college to support each other and to like kind of, they're their people, if you will, always. And I think that's such an astute way to find customers is to really, niche down to one or two of them. And that becomes your client base. That's brilliant. Because there's always going to be people coming in, especially on the sports side, to your point, because that is the piece that you started the podcast with, which I thought was also super brilliant. Are there groups there that you can tap into, the athletes? And that's, super brilliant. There's so much more I want to ask you, Beth. So there's got to be some part two here. There's more to to dissect. I think it is now more than ever, and it has been around forever, that it is a niche that, if done right, again, can yield great return, both for yourself and also serve a need, which is the key to real estate investing. So thank you so much for being on, Beth. How can everyone listening learn more about all the great things you're doing and projects you're up to?
Well, first off, thank you for having me. And you can find me on Instagram at Investing with Beth, on TikTok at Investing with Beth. You can go to my website, read more about me, investingwithbeth.com. If you want to text me, 513-470-1078. So always happy to chat with anyone, especially if you're getting started, if you want to know more about student housing or just anything about my journey.
Very cool. Thank you so much for being on our show, Beth. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to receive updates on our next interviews, go to our website, therealestateinvestor.com. There, you can subscribe to our show, become part of our investor community, and get updates on upcoming episodes.
If you like our show, please share with other women who would benefit. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. And as always, we encourage you to take one action as a result of today's show and put it into motion so you can live both a financially free and balanced life. Thanks for spending time with us.
Ciao.